Hello again, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, brought to you by Shoshimworks in collaboration with the NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, CEO of Shoshimworks, a global advisory firm helping organizations and nations execute and explore ecosystemic transformation. Our world is increasingly interconnected, and ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we innovate and build for the future. In this series, we're exploring how these ecosystemic models are impacting every facet of society. And today, we'll be reflecting on the first two seasons, revisiting some of our favorite moments, and digging into some of the macro themes that have emerged across these incredible discussions. We'll spend some time exploring the importance of ecosystems, innovation, interdisciplinary collaboration, where trust is heading, and the future of society and industry. My co-hosts today are Marco Annunziata, Tom Cook, and Anna Powell. Marco, why don't we start with you, and we'll run around the table here real quick with some introductions.
Thank you, Diane. I'm Marco Annunziata. I'm a co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors, which is a boutique advisory on economics and technology. I was brought up as an economist, and my colleagues here are painfully aware that makes me a very annoying person to be with, but I've developed a passion for technology, which I think makes me acceptable together with my accent, which I'm told is my strongest selling point.
Tom, over to you.
Tom Cook, co-founder and CEO of Spacely, a digital talent marketplace where we're increasing access to aerospace projects and tasks through a talent marketplace model, really focused on the future of work, and have really enjoyed being with this team over the last 3 years. As we've dove into these models and frameworks and new structures. And yes, definitely have envy of having an Italian accent versus a Southern accent from Virginia.
And I'm Ed Powell. I'm the CEO of TensorX. We leverage the cloud, the crowd, and AI to inform strategy, to drive innovation, and optimize performance from design and procurement through planning and real-time deployment. And it, too, for me, has been a great time being with all of you and this journey over the last 3 years.
Thanks, Ed. And I honestly can't think of any better co-pilots for this journey other than this crew and the NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project team, with whom we've had the privilege of partnering for this series. And NASA, is, as we all know, has been a longstanding an iconic leader in the identification and resolution of wicked problems for society, for industry. And we've had the opportunity to really walk alongside them in this particular podcast series and help them connect with some of the world's leading thinkers who are conducting really relevant research and market development in arenas that are relevant to the work that NASA is leading. Through the Ecosystemic Futures podcast, we've had the opportunity to connect with over 20 world-class experts to explore some of their work and worldviews in the arenas of research, insights, and new market models. And through this journey, we've had the opportunity to really explore countless new perspectives in the way that the world is coming together to form value for industry and society. And it's clear in those through those conversations that the world is in fact becoming much more interconnected, and ecosystemic models are reshaping the way industries and organizations are driving value. So throughout this podcast and in the many conversations that we've had the opportunity to explore, we've seen this dance between extreme specialists and the work that they're doing and the need to maintain a very kind of system orientation in the way we see things fitting together and knitting together. So this tension between deep specialization and systemic perspective has been really, I think, a constant theme throughout many of the conversations that we've hosted with these experts. So maybe, Marco, if we can start with you, what's your perspective regarding kind of the economic impact of the tension between systemic design and deep specialization and how these two domains kind of come together and show up in industry and society in these new models.
Yes, Diane. For me, this has been probably one of the most interesting aspects of our two series, because as you've pointed out, we've moved towards a world of increased specialization, almost inevitably because there's been so much technical progress, so much progress in knowledge that the high degree of specialization in different fields becomes to some extent inevitable. But if at the same time, as we have seen, ecosystems, ecosystemic models become the driving force, these are models that by definition rely on the intersection and the interplay of different disciplines. Therefore, it becomes, from an economic standpoint, very inefficient to have a situation where very few people have a grasp of the overall big picture. So if everybody is just a specialist and we just rely on the equivalent of the economic invisible hand to create an efficient ecosystem, that is not necessarily going to happen in the best and most desirable way, especially in a situation where you have decision-making involved. So one thing that I found extremely valuable in our series is having created a framework that allows individuals to get a fast and reasonably deep understanding of fields which are different from their own field of specialization. You're not going to become an expert in everything, but having the ability to gain a sufficiently deep understanding of other fields, I think, makes you much better at understanding the role of the ecosystem in the economy or in a specific industry, and therefore puts you in a much better position to then leverage your own expertise to the benefit of your own activity and the ecosystem as a whole. So that's why, Diane, I think this was probably one of the strongest values that our framework and our series have brought.
Just because you have an ecosystem doesn't mean you have a good ecosystem. And so the importance really of this concept of kind of cross-disciplinary pollinization, of looking at both anything from psychological profiles to deep knowledge to skills and understanding, and being able to raise everyone to understand things in kind of an analogical way, like are there analogies we can draw from various areas, are extremely powerful in the solving of, you know, wicked problems, other things that we think would be key objectives of any future ecosystem.
Yeah. I think that's super important. I think some of the micro-learning kind of tools that we heard from Andrew Powell were quite helpful in kind of establishing that framework for constant learning and orientation. And Tom, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that, you know, being in the Air Force for 24 years, we had an IPT structure and program management for space systems. So that wasn't as novel, from a standpoint of we recognize the value of cross-functional IPTs. We had to have that for any success in the program. But what I think I did get from, you know, the discussions this year was just the pace of change and the velocity that's required in today's landscape, where it was fine to put a cross-functional IPT together that would hold together for the duration of the program, and those programs maybe 5 years, 10 years. I think folks are still in that mindset where they recognize there is value there, and they don't know if that's something new that's being discussed. And to me, I think what was new was, how do you take advantage of those analogies, that cross-function, but in a way that's adaptable to the velocity and pace of technological change that we're seeing? I mean, we've been talking about future of work things where we didn't even have job descriptions last year for prompt engineers or generative AI, and look at where we were just a year later. And as we're going through this entire series, the technological landscape was shifting right underneath of our very feet, and we're the ones discussing this, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And Tom, to your point, and actually this is back to your point as well, Marco, but just this very strong interplay between the future of work and the future of cities and the future of education, right? We find ourselves in a position where, because of the dynamism in markets today, we can't look at one of those domains in isolation, right? The future of work necessitates a very strong linkage with education. And frankly, we've seen also in our conversations with folks like Tom Cheesewright, also the implications for cities, right, and facilities Kate Lister also gave us a lot to think about in this interplay as well. But if we think about the interconnectedness and the multidisciplinary kind of lens that we need to apply to the systems design, moving technologies forward for work necessitates a close follow in educational futures, right? And a close alignment with basically facilities management and city planning, economic planning. So maybe back around to you, Marco. If we think about this ecosystemic landscape of basically constellations of work, innovation that are taking place in different domains, how do we even approach making the appropriate connections and keeping maintaining an alignment across the different domains so that as a society and throughout industry, we're helping each other move along? Into Ed's point, achieving better outcomes versus really disconnected and chaotic marketplaces and economic kind of environments.
I think the best way is to do it really in a recursive way, because as you've pointed out, Diane, there is a very complex interplay of technological innovation disrupting different sectors, whether it's the way we work, the education sector, the way that we are living together. And to me, that was brought up very clearly in the session we had with Tom Cheesewright on the future of cities, for example, where I could see a clash of different trends, which is very striking. Because on the one hand, you could say, well, we've seen the pandemic highlighting the risks of living in close proximity. And at the same time, we have loads of innovation that are making distributed work and remote work a lot more efficient. And you look at it from the point of view of the economic future of the country and of the world, and it seems like a fantastic opportunity because it means the opportunity to have a much more distributed innovation ecosystem and a much more distributed productive production ecosystem, which then also means probably being able to alleviate social tensions and economic disparity by spreading economic growth more evenly across the country. But does it mean that we are losing the cities? The cities have always been one of the biggest focuses of innovation, one of the biggest focuses of education, where people really come together. So how do we look at the way that we should rethink education given this change in trends of how we interact as humans? And how do we then bring it back, thinking about reforming education, to what Ed was noting earlier, which is the need for different jobs? You know, Ed and Tom both highlighted this, the need to think about different jobs coming up as new technologies come along. So that's why I'm saying that doing it recursively is the only way to do it. You look at what's happening in cities, then you look at what's happening in innovation, and then Tom comes along and tells you, hey, but there are these different job opportunities coming out now because of these innovations that we hadn't considered, and you go back. And iterating is, I think, is the only way to get a grip on this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great point, Marco. The issue is that you have to be agile. Everything has to be iterative and agile. You know, one of the things we discussed in the value-based optimization discussion was this idea of optimizing complex systems. What wasn't really discussed in detail is that the way the best optimization works is that the underlying optimizer is a greedy algorithm. So every agent underneath is acting in his or her essentially own interest. And the key to optimizing those complex systems is the order in which you issue the tasks. So you basically create an ecosystem where everyone can act in a completely self-centered way, but you order the tasks in such a way that when they do that, you get an optimal outcome. And I think most of what we've seen have been kind of bifurcated around two approaches. Either we're trying to globally optimize everything and, you know, to hell with the individual, or it's all about the individual and we can't make these global, you know, we can't essentially achieve our global goals. It turns out there's a way that you can have people acting in a self-interested way that you still achieve your larger goals. And I think that actually is a nuance of the ecosystem that somehow lots of people have missed.
Yeah, I think that's going to be interesting in the future. I just saw an article yesterday by Robert Reich, from the former labor secretary, talking about, you know, working for AI in the future. And then you bring up, I think that's a good point, and it goes back to some of the mapping exercises, you know, with the CAS team at NASA, where you map these outcomes and you map the utopian and dystopian futures. And you say, okay, if you can design the system, and it goes back to systems thinking and ecosystemic thinking for those positive attributes and the utopian outcomes, I think it would be very interesting to see, you know, is this how, you know, 2000 AI we're working for, or is this, hey, this is where you can both simultaneously achieve your self-interest while we also get to this global common goal. But achieving consensus on what those global goals are continue to be challenged. And I think we saw that in our discussions as well. You know, climate change is a great example that came up in a lot of discussion about the implications on, you know, the economics, the future of cities, education, all these pieces we're talking about that interleave. And yet you don't have global consensus on what that definition of the crisis or emergency or definition of it is. And so if you rely then on the system from an artificial intelligence standpoint, putting out those tasks in a specific order to achieve a preferred outcome, then the discussion and tension comes around those preferred outcomes, regardless of the self-interest. So it'll be really interesting to see if we get to this point where some folks did discuss, you know, we talked a lot about AI this year. It will be interesting to see if you recognize if you're working for a human or a machine. I argue we are already working for machines. We're somewhat subjugated to having a phone in our hand or a laptop in our face. And, you know, that email comes across, a human provided that, but that machine tells you it's there. And it prompts a response from you. So these ideas that, again, we found maybe were novel or maybe new to some folks, people are saying, well, we're doing this already. And what are we really building on here with the thinking? And I think that's where we would like to see next season go, is how do we continue to take these thoughts, these big thoughts, and make them pragmatic and practical in a way where we can then start to experiment with not just NASA, but other partners from economics, from education, from future cities, as a result of all these great conversations we've had.
You know, one of the, and you've all touched on this as well, but I'd love to kind of pull the thread a bit. One of the themes that we have heard throughout most of these conversations is the emerging currency of trust, right? In markets that are increasingly dynamic, interconnected, and digitally oriented, right? We necessarily have to address an infrastructure and a protocol for trust. We heard from folks like Reid Blackman about ethics and AI and designing for not bad, right? How we can create these vastly interconnected systems so that the unintended consequences don't show up in a harmful way. So what is the new infrastructure for trust and currency of trust? And how do we need to be thinking about the trust and transparency in the design of these systems? To Ed's earlier point, ecosystems can be intentional and designed for good, but we have to factor in the experience of all the actors in these systems. So back around to you, Marco, how should we be thinking about trust in these very dynamic and interconnected systems?
That's one of the hardest and most important questions, because what we've seen recently is that recent digital innovations have mostly gone in the direction of destroying trust. We see it with social media, not only in social media, but there is zero doubt that in my mind that trust has been eroded to a very significant extent. Now, further innovations, including generative artificial intelligence, have the potential to make it even worse, to spread more misinformation. Artificial intelligence has the potential to make censorship even more efficient than it has been over the last few years. So trust is potentially the biggest issue on the table. Now, one issue that came up in our podcast series, which gave me some hope, is the potential to leverage technology itself, for example, with blockchain, in order to bring ownership and responsibility and agency back to the individual, and thereby trying to underpin a stronger system of trust in the design of the systems. I would say, though, that reconnecting here to something that Tom was saying earlier, Diane, which is the difficulties that we always encounter in agreeing on the big goals, the big objectives, the values we want to ensure. I would say that even beyond the technical design of the ecosystems, something that we have shown in these discussions, including with the CAST team at NASA, is the value of open discussions where you push the envelope, where you challenge the assumptions, where you move away from a framework which we see too often in the public sphere, where you start by saying, well, we all know that X is true, and therefore let's draw the consequences. And instead you move into a situation where you say, well, we don't actually take anything for granted. We try to learn and we challenge everything in an open-minded way. And that, I think, in our discussions has proven extremely fruitful, not only to design possible scenarios and how different policies would adapt to different scenarios, but also in increasing trust through open discussions that allow everybody to show a degree of open-mindedness and to learn. So I think this combination of technological innovations, perhaps mostly through blockchain, and more open, more wide-ranging discussions, I think are going to be the key to restoring the trust which we need to move forward.
So as the medieval person in this group, I always love historic forms. And there's a concept, a very ancient concept called subsidiarity. And the idea of subsidiarity is that you want every issue that has to be dealt with at the most local level it can be dealt with. So you can't deal with national defense at the county level, and you shouldn't deal with the local school board at the national level. But this idea of a kind of radius of influence or a radius of trust or a radius of connectivity. I mean, with my family, I'm completely a communitarian. And with the national government, I'm a libertarian. So the closer that radius is to us, and it's probably like gravitation is probably 1/r², the stronger our proclivity toward communitarianism and trust. Now, what's interesting is that people have used AI in recent years in things like academic development to create alignment around particular goals of graduates. So, for example, they find that if a graduate's very interested, say, in water rights in Africa, and you can tie a program at a university to water rights or water production in Africa, they're much more likely to give around those thematic components. You can develop communities around those specific themes that can significantly reduce your radius, your equal probable sphere of influence. And I think that those are going to be more and more important things. But these, again, ancient ideas don't go away. They just map into a new ecosystem.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's where I was coming back to with this discussion was community, because old communities, analog communities, were built along that trust because you were in the same neighborhood. You went to the same church, maybe. You went to the same work site that was local. And now some of that has eroded because of how this changing nature of this digital adoption has created, to me, it's the pros and cons. You have the pros of having now an infinite number of communities you can belong to and feel associated with. And you can build your own trust in those communities, whether they're, right next to you or they're around the world. And, we look at the platform economy in this, when I look at Airbnb and Uber, I used to joke, and we talked to the Airbnb ethics person, Rob Chestnut, at one point about, well, how did you build trust that, in the old days, if you told me, hey, I'm going to go sleep on a stranger's couch, I might have thought, what's the probability of me being murdered in my sleep, right? And now we just say, okay, we can trust that we're going to survive a night on some stranger's couch, halfway around the world by interfacing with this digital platform called Airbnb. And similarly, you can get in a stranger's car in Uber, which sounds like hitchhiking, just 30 years ago. So we've established some trust. We still look at the cons and say, well, someone could put cameras in the Airbnb, or someone could still
murder you, you know, in the car. And to me, that's no different than if I go next door to my neighbor, they could also have cameras in the house that I'm not knowledgeable of. So, and then there's an erosion of trust if that's discovered. So this idea of community, I think, is really important with how do you establish that trust? And to me, to Ed's point, the only way you do that is you start building communities. And then how do you handle what strengthens communities in the analog sense is you go through a natural disaster or something, everyone comes together, it strengthens, you know, through that unfortunate incident, right? How do we strengthen in a similar fashion these digital non-analog communities where you may not be right next door or even know who your neighbor is? I'm in Denver. There's been a lot of migration both to and from here. A lot of change in the neighborhood since we bought a house here in 2010, you know, 13 years, we've seen a lot of change. So when you have that much type of mobility that we didn't used to have, you know, it's now incumbent on not just trust in the digital space, but in the analog space as well. And so as opposed to getting to this chaotic future where you don't have it anywhere, how do you establish a framework for that that can both be analog and digital simultaneously and something you can actually rely on?
Yeah, I think everyone is trying to figure out that framework and find the beneficial paths forward. And one of the additional themes that we heard consistently throughout many of our conversations and really ties, I think, nicely with this concept of drawing inspiration from ancient ideas and kind of timeless frameworks and timeless kind of analogical references, but we also heard throughout these conversations that there is still much that we can learn from basically bio-inspired design. What nature can teach us, right? The evolution of nature can teach us for the inspiration of our systems of networked businesses, greater network connectivity in society. So how should we be kind of thinking about bio-inspired design as we move forward? Is there more that we can pull into the way we build frameworks for industry, frameworks for society as we become much more interconnected and markets become more dynamic? Back around to you, Marco.
Ingrid, and there's no doubt that nature still has an enormous amount to teach us. I think here I'm putting my economist hat back on for a second. They would say the following. As we're evolving more and more towards a much stronger role for platforms, for the platform economy, for ecosystemic models, as we've been saying, we can learn more and more from nature. So the examples we see in nature become even more relevant and even more immediately mappable to the experience we have. What I would caution against, though, is a kind of, call it excessive enthusiasm or irrational exuberance or even arrogance that we tend to have when we look at nature and we say, we can replicate that, we can improve it, we can do it better. And then inevitably, we mess it up. We mess it up because we are completely unable to see the whole picture. We are completely unable to foresee the unintended consequences and the way incentives will play out. So to me, the salutary lesson is let's look at nature more and more to help us understand how the ecosystems work and how the ecosystemic models can unfold, but to understand more than to then drive big top-down decisions on how to shape these ecosystems. And let's have more, and here perhaps I echo the subsidiarity principle that Ed mentioned, but let's have the ecosystem develop more from the bottom up, which is the way that nature actually works. So I think finding the right balance between understanding and remaining humble and not messing it up from the top down is going to be crucial in my view.
Yeah, I think those are great points, Marco. And, you know, when you look at nature, you see things like, large oak trees, a number of which have fallen in my various yards. And then you think of Tom and you think of the aspens, and you're basically seeing these ecosystems that are not about one root system. It's a interconnected set of roots and trunks and leaves that are all nourishing this community. And the strength of that is so much greater than what appears to be this massive oak. And I do think that, you know, questions there of stability. Again, the mindset, though, as you mentioned, Marco, that, you know, it's never about just accomplishing one thing. There's always these trade-offs that have to be considered underneath, because that's what creates a sense of buy-in, a sense of trust, and a frankly, coherence that drives ecosystemic stability.
Yeah, and I think, and I love the biomimicry discussions we've had this year. You know, I worked in a little bit of that while I was in the DoD, and, you know, can we make a Navy SEAL swim like a seal? Can we make him climb like a gecko? You know, and then, like you said, Marco, we'd inevitably, you know, maybe screw something up because they're not geckos, they're not seals, right? But we were saying, what can we learn from nature? And this is where I think some of the AI discussions we had were interesting, where, you know, there was some discussion about, is AI just a mirror of our current humanity, right? And it doesn't take into account the evolution of the last million years or billion years, whereas nature has that advantage over the machine, right? And so these things that may appear relevant or, you know, somewhat repeatable, it, you know, we say, okay, well, we don't really know what actually built that up over those last million to billion years. And so how do we know that we're not screwing that up? Because, you know, over that period of time, there's been a lot of changes that have occurred. We've gone through multiple heating periods, multiple cooling periods on the Earth. So, you know, you don't know what's baked into the DNA. And we've talked about in recent conversations with the, you know, all the cell replication within the human body alone and the DNA that's resident there and the resilience of that biome. So, you know, I think that from a sustainability standpoint, we have this natural tension between the economics and having the economic supportability and sustainability of humanity in its current systems and artificial structures in tension with nature and, you know, the biodiversity that we enjoy here, you know, on planet Earth, and that are maybe not constrained artificially in the same structures, right? Those organisms, those structures have been built in from an evolutionary standpoint. And I think when we look at that from how does this apply to business, to future of cities, to future of education, and future of work, that all comes into account from a standpoint of we're working within artificialities and constraints and even a mirror in some folks' regard of what we're using with AI to help parse the large amounts of data that we've produced as humans over the last 100-some years to then competing with something that's been around for a lot longer. And again, that natural tension of where do we fit within that system and what is our role in that system and how should we interact in that system and how much do we get to play the hand of puppeteer versus just allowing things to move more freely.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Tom, you've touched on so many of the great conversations that we had, but knitting together the work and the worldview across the multitude of conversations that we've had, I think there are a lot of paths to greater goodness if we take lessons from many of the portfolios of work that these folks are leading. And I'm just reflecting on so many of them as I'm listening to all of you. And I certainly have my favorites, really, is someone who is really focused on ecosystemic transformation and moving, you know, with the benefit of the platform economy and in this heightened level of interconnectivity, both within industry and society. You know, I have a bias towards really those conversations and perspectives that we've heard that have the elements of strategic surprise, right, that we heard from Mickey McManus, and then have a strong focus on systemic thinking that we heard from David Bray and so many others that really shirk conventional norms, right, that we heard, I think, throughout all of the conversations that we had. So I have a lot of favorites throughout the past two series of podcast episodes, but I'd love to really just kind of walk around the digital table here and reflect on some of your favorites. Maybe, Marco, if we can start with you, what were some of your, I think, more important discoveries in the conversations over the past two seasons?
So I'll say some of the most powerful moments for me were the discussion we had with Anne Connolly on blockchain technology and how it can help to shift the balance of power back to the individual and to increase transparency. This goes back to the discussion we had on trust and democracy and how we keep the system going. And I'll mention again the future of cities with Tom Cheesewright. I think that was a fascinating discussion simply because the people have noted, there's a very interesting book on this, Scale, which points out how every big system, every big organization eventually breaks down and decays. Can be large animals, it can be corporations, and the only notable exception is cities. Large cities have proven to be much more long-lasting than anything else, and the idea of that this might now be coming to an end, I think, has been especially fascinating. And lastly, you know, the most fascinating discussion for me has been, as you mentioned, with Mickey McMahon, so on, the concept of strategic surprises and how do you surprise yourself, which takes us back to what we started with, which is the importance of interdisciplinary work. There's a sentence that Mickey said in the podcast which stuck with me, which is, disciplines are totally artificial, which is a very stark statement, which, because we are forced, we are habituated to think in terms of discipline, but that simple statement tells you that the value is at the edges, where you bleed from one discipline into the next and you have cross-pollination. So these for me would be the highlights of a series which has been really full of fascinating and extremely interesting moments.
I would second that. I thought the discussion around design fiction was a new term that came out of that from Mickey. So I have a friend, Ellen Levy, who was an early employee at LinkedIn, but before that, she ran a thing called MediaX at Stanford. And what it looked at that was these kind of what we would call cross-disciplinary projects. And we would always say, this is even back in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, the most interesting things occur at the intersection of traditional disciplines. So we were always using, you know, genetic algorithms, for example, in optimizing complex systems because we're mimicking nature. And we even see it that it's a reciprocal relationship because our understanding of artificial neural networks improves our understanding of neuroscience, right? The way the brain, if you're deprived of food or oxygen or whatever, the brain will begin to pare down the neural network, make it a smaller neural network for you to be able to work. And then we see it now in treating things like PTSD, where certain psychedelics actually kind of enliven neuroplasticity. They create new connections between neurons that actually allow you to essentially retrain your brain to not suffer from those diseases. And so I thought that strategic surprise was interesting. There's no, you know, there's no discipline, either interdisciplinary or the disciplines themselves are, you know, artificial constructs. And then really the bringing in of the meta everything. I mean, this gets back to Marco's point about you have to have this overarching mission and view of the ecosystem. But, you know, Mickey talks about everything in kind of a meta layer discussion. Everything is not physics, it's metaphysics. You know, it's metabiology, it's synthetic biology. And I think that as a guy who, you know, started his college career as a philosophy major and ended up with a PhD in aerospace engineering, I like that because I think that's actually how we create these interconnections. It's not necessarily at the lower level, but rather at this meta level. And one last thing on that, one of the reasons why I always loved aerospace was because you were always having to make trade-offs, right? You had thermal, you had power, you had thrust, you had avionics, you had structures, but you were always making trade-offs because the system was constrained. And I think that mindset brings us to really understanding these ways of not only narrowing what we do, but then also understanding the opportunity to flare and look for things like strategic surprise, looking for things going from impossible to impractical.
Yeah, I think for me, that those are some really big concepts, right? And which is really exciting to think through and engage with and be confronted with and really debate. It goes back to what Marco was saying about having the open debate. Don't provide that anything's just a given.
And the one that was, I think, a little bit more pragmatic for me was talking with Julie and Jen over at Ford Motor Company. And I feel like to get to some of these larger discussions we're having, right, we have to see, well, where does the proverbial rubber meet the road? And Ford Motor Company, you know, the Blue Oval has been around forever. It's iconic. It's an iconic brand. And working with them and talking with them and hearing how they were looking at the future of design and future of work and the integration between those two pieces, I feel like brought it down to a practical application of what you're talking about, Ed, where you have these meta layers that are different, right? You have different trade-offs in what materials you procure. How do you put it together? Do you use robots or humans? You know, what is your cost trade-off and your price point so you can get a consumer to actually, you know, purchase it? It's not, you know, too much, but you can still create some type of revenue and profitability off of it. And then, of all things, be the one that started the Model T and, you know, the line of, you know, work that has really promulgated into corporate America and, you know, over the last 100 years as an example and even an exemplar of how you mass produce things, right? And then with the changing nature of work, how Ford is looking at reinventing itself so it doesn't go the way of the dodo bird and it stays around for another 100 years. And then we had, even within our own community of communities, we had Darren Murph, who talked about some of remote and future of work and all of that. We find out during, you know, the end part of the series, he gets hired on by Ford. Right. So, you know, we have these interconnected pieces that, you know, even our own communities that we've built, you know, to come and discuss these things have recognized the value that each of them bring from their own areas. And then again, I think, you know, Ed, you're exactly right about the meta piece of this, right? You can, you know, we talked physics, we talked, you know, economics, we talked policy and regulation and where all these things meet. And you need to have people that could. The more interesting ones to me were the ones that could talk all of those things. And it goes back to whether or not we're hyper-specialized or we're generalist in nature and what the economic value is going to be of the future for a person. You know, is it going to be a very specialized or more generalist person? But I found that was a great conversation to really take some of these bigger ideas and bring it down to a more pragmatic, practical view and application, albeit with an iconic brand that is, to me, literally always struggling to survive another day. And because if they don't figure that out, business is tough, right? So I think that was a great way to really encapsulate some of these larger, more theoretical, you know, discussions into something more practical.
Yeah, and as a follow-on to Tom, I thought the discussion with Brian Evergreen was really interesting in that, for one, he pointed out that between 13 and 17% of AI projects are viewed as being successful, which I think is a very interesting insight about that. That, by the way, is not that different from the initial ERP implementations. You know, people used to write off $100 million SAP pilots. But I found it interesting that to make AI more useful and even better, we need to make it more human. We need to, and one of the other lines he had that I liked was, you know, ChatGPT is not your corporate strategy. So it goes back to Marco's earlier point about understanding the value to all the stakeholders and being able to understand how AI plays a role in that ecosystem, but finding alignment at a mission level above that.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think every one of us have had these conversations about the opportunity for these ecosystemic models, these meta market models, really to both optimize performance of systems, but also elevate the human experience. And we keep coming back to that human condition and that human experience, right? So as we're designing these systems and I think gaining greater proficiency with the level of interdependency and interconnectivity, right, across all of these systems and constellations of systems. Ultimately, the end game here is to elevate the human experience. So we do that with intention, right? The stage is really set here for everlasting change, right? The world is increasingly interconnected, ecosystemic, and for our listeners here and for the season. I think we have shown the importance of agility, to Ed's point, collaboration, interdisciplinary awareness, and systems thinking in order to continue to dance the delicate dance between the meta market models and the specialized innovation underneath that underpin the growth and resilience of these systems as we work together to transform the future. And really with that, we'll have to wrap up our thoughts there and just really invite our audience to stay with us and come with us into the next season. And as we do this, we would be remiss not to thank once again the NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project team for their leadership of these conversations. So just let's run around the horn very quickly. And final parting thoughts, Marco, Ed, Tom, for this season as we reflect on the past two seasons and look forward to what's next.
I'll go first again. And I'll see, we've summarized right now the key learnings on these two seasons. They've been exceptional. I'm very much looking forward to season number three. I think the challenge for us in season number three will be to go even deeper in the learnings we can get from the cross-fertilization of different disciplines, and also in being even sharper in understanding the impact on the aviation sector, but also on the space economy and on the rest of the US and global economy, spelling it out in terms of time horizon. I think for me personally, one of the more interesting issues in season three will be to understand better of all the changes, the innovations we're discussing, how much of the impact will show up in the next 5 years within our lifetimes, how much of it will be pushed back further into the future.
Yeah, I agree with Marco. I always think it's interesting when we're trying to convey some idea to actually embody it. And so I so appreciate being able to be part of this crowd. So I'm honored and pleased. And it's been a great ride. And we look forward to season three as we continue to look at the ecosystemic futures.
Yeah, I think that I'm looking forward to obviously the great conversations to follow ones we already have. So it's going to be, I think, tough to continue to find, you know, the folks that are this engaged and this committed. I know they're out there. I think getting some additional voices are always going to be, you know, really good to hear from, you know, where, again, maybe those voices coming from areas of surprise, to our point earlier about where's the surprising. And I think that's what I'm looking forward to, is where can we find some voices that are really of surprise for us. I think operating, navigating, you know, this new future, I think back to, as we talk about what we've said before, where we look at the past to inform the future, and I think about, you know, you had, you know, the television, you had radio before that, you had print before that. How were people communicating at that base level, you know, before all of these additional mediums? We've just introduced more mediums and more complexity, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have to take advantage of it. You've had some folks talk about social media maybe even not being around in 5 to 10 years because of some of the downfalls of it. So wouldn't that be interesting to talk to some folks in season three about where we were just talking about how social media affects future of work, future cities, future education, and then it just not be even around in 5 years from now. So yeah, very much looking forward to those types of conversations in season three. Can't wait for our listeners to stay with us in the new season and also see what the NASA has in store for, you know, priorities in those discussions coming up as well. Those are always exciting to hear, obviously, from the NASA team on what they were really interested in learning more about.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yep. I think we have an exciting new season in front of us, and I am really looking forward to connecting with those brilliant minds. And to that point, for our listeners here today, the Ecosystemic Futures podcast is provided to you by SocianWorks and very close collaboration with the NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, who are connecting the world's brilliant minds with wicked opportunities to help us better innovate, operate, and navigate our increasingly connected world. Please feel free to look for additional episodes of this podcast series on Apple iTunes or wherever you find your favorite podcast series. And you can always find more at SocianWorks.com. And we thank you all for hanging with us in these past two seasons and welcome you to what lies ahead. Thanks, everyone.